Hello, and welcome to the Vicar's Watch Dibbly,
the podcast where real priests talk about pop culture and what we've learnt about faith, life and the church. We watch Dibbly, and now we're watching everything else. I'm Kate.
I'm Ross.
And I'm Ruthie, and today we are going to talk about The Prince of Egypt, which is a film from 1998, which holds a lot of nostalgia for all of us. We talk about the films, the bits we loved from it, the music that we've loved from it, and about adapting biblical stories. What are the good things to do with it, and what shouldn't be done? And then we talk about which ones we'd like to do ourselves.
Vicarages, and you're listening in. We're ready and raring to talk today about The Prince of Egypt. What an epic Woo-hoo! Musical. But first, Ooh. Some notices. Kate, what have you got for us?
Well, if you're listening to this episode on its day of release, or indeed the day after it's released, this episode is being released just before Mothering Sunday in the UK. That's a fourth Sunday of Lent. So this is your warning. If you haven't bought a card and a bunch of flowers for someone who mothers you, this is your chance to do it before Mothering Sunday.
Alert! Action stations!
You have been warned.
One of the reasons we picked Prince of Egypt to talk about is because the story of Moses' birth is one of the readings for Mothering Sunday, so we thought it would fit in a little bit. If you are not in the UK and you're in part of a world where Mother's Day happens in the summer, you might be a bit confused, but Mothering Sunday is a little bit different. We won't get into too much of that now. We'll save that for an episode next year, maybe, to unpick exactly what Mothering Sunday is. But one of the things that I've been doing in preparation for Mothering Sunday is I've been planning a messy church, which I'm having on the day of recording. It's tomorrow, and we're going to be making paper flower bouquets, which is very exciting. So I've been having lots of fun playing with tissue paper and florist tape and various things to work out different ways to make paper flowers, and trying not to make them look too perfect, because that will put the children off, I think. But also planning our Mothering Sunday service and publicising it across Facebook and all of that fun.
Oh, that sounds really nice. Yeah.
You've unlocked a memory of one of my friends, well, two of my friends, Rosie and Dave, when they got married, ended up making loads of paper flowers, as did lots of our friends for their wedding, because all their flowers were paper flowers. So.
Oh, that's special.
There you go. That's really special.
Nice. We must take photos of your flowers, Kate, and we'll get them on the socials, because as a nice Mothering Sunday treat. There you go. Ruthie, you've got a story for us. I love your stories, Ruthie.
Are you sure?
they can only be you.
Indeed.
Like, these things only ever happen to Ruthie.
Yeah, I have another story of embarrassment to share with you all. I hope that's
Hooray!
Cool. It does not involve a funeral and a spa this time, but it does involve me heading off to a meeting and arriving half an hour early. So naturally, just thought, oh, I'll just pot around the shops for a bit. There's a big B&M. Who doesn't love a B&M? Bargains with all the stuff that you don't know that you need, and it's all at discounted prices, and it's full of really weird stuff as well. Why wouldn't you want to?
It sounds like the middle aisle of a Lidl or an Aldi, but just the whole shop.
Yeah.
But that's like the entire shop. Yes, there's a toy section normally, and some beauty, and often gardening and craft and
Halloween
and
costumes,
homeware. Halloween. Yeah, it's all of that stuff, but it's also just full of some weird stuff. And so I was just pottering around the aisles, and I was talking to a friend on the phone at the time, and I was stopped in my tracks on the beauty aisle at some face masks. But it turns out they were not face masks. Turns out that they were shake your coconut's boob mask and shake your booty bum mask. And
cool, blimey.
Got immediately distracted by these, and they are literally masks for your boob and your boob. You might have one, you might have two, you might have three if you're in the song by Busted about the year 3000.
You may, like me, have none.
Yeah, exactly. But it might be good for nipples. Who knows? Most of us have nipples, I think, in different ways. And a mask for your bottom. The bum mask actually has underwear printed on it as well, which is very nice. And I thought, that's amazing. I must buy both because I enjoy a novelty item. I am a fan of a novelty. What I'd totally forgotten, though, is I was wearing my dog collar walking around after I'd immediately put these into my basket. So thought, I'm going to have an interesting conversation with the lady at the checkout. But she was very professional. I maybe pulled my scarf up a little higher than it was. Yeah. And we got through the ordeal together. And I will be trying them at some point soon. And we'll let you know the results.
Keep us posted.
Yeah.
Keep us abreast. Keep us abreast of the situation.
You, but I will.
Yeah. Here's a little silver lining. Could have been worse. You could have run into the bishop in B&M Bargains.
That's true, and I was going to a meeting with the bishop, so that there was a very definite possibility of bumping into the bishop.
They might have been flung over the meeting table.
I did put them in the car before I went into the meeting room because I thought, I don't want these to slip out my bag accidentally and have to explain myself, because I don't need to explain myself, quite frankly. Yes, we've got to look after our bodies. Mm. And who wouldn't want something infused with rich coconut oil to nourish and hydrate your skin, helping to enhance your boobs back to their bouncy self?
And on that note...
Yes, let's move on. Thank you, Ruthie. On that note, the Prince of Egypt, apparently.
Prince of Egypt.
Well, he does look very moisturised throughout the film. You know, for someone living in that area of the world in that time period before sun cream, etc. You know, he looks very young for the whole movie.
I have to say, I probably had quite a crush on Moses in this film. Either of you have a crush? No, great. We'll move on.
No, I think I had a bit. I see that. I mean, you know, I grew up not knowing I was gay, but I can look back and think, yes, no, handsome man.
Handsome man.
Yeah, yeah.
Not Ramesses, but Moses.
We should probably cover the basics before we go into character lore.
Before we start thirsting over the characters.
So, The Prince of Egypt was an animated film that was released in 1998, an adaptation of the Exodus story of Moses, the Prince of Egypt, as he encounters a spiritual journey. And one that leads him to bring the Hebrew people out of Egypt and on their way into the wilderness. It's a really fun adaptation of the Bible story. And actually, most people will probably know the Exodus story because of this film. Now, it came out in 1998. I didn't see it in the cinema when it came out. I think we saw it a couple of years later. Did either of you see it when it came out?
No, at that point I was living in a market town and we didn't really have a good cinema. There was something that occasionally showed films, but no.
I'm fairly certain I did, because I remember being completely overawed by the scene where the Red Sea's parted, because that on a big screen was just epic. Fantastic. Wow. Like, yeah, and with all the sound around you and the seas rising up, I remember that being just amazing. So I'm pretty sure we would have been in Bradford at the time. I think we probably went to the cinema in Bradford to go see it.
I bet that if cinemas re-released it, you know, and did a screening, people would flock to go and see it again on
absolutely.
The big screen.
And
maybe even sing along. It is a musical and it has got some of the greatest songs in it. I've ended up watching it quite a bit. I just, over the years, I think in my sort of adulthood, I just adore it. I think it's a really fabulous adaptation. And the cast is amazing as well. It's the voice cast is stellar.
Yeah.
Goodness. So just to give some of the cast.
Yeah, go for it, Reedy.
So the main character of Moses is played by Val Kilmer, a.k.a. Batman.
Indeed.
A.k.a. Iceman in Top Gun. Then you've got Ralph Fiennes, who plays Ramesses, who we're going to hear from in next week's... next episode. Next fortnight, he makes an appearance. Michelle Pfeiffer plays Zipporah. Sandra Bullock is Miriam. Jeff Goldblum's in it as Aaron. Then you've got Danny Glover plays Aaron. Tomato. You've got Danny Glover, who plays Jethro. Patrick Stewart and Helen Mirren play the Pharaoh and the Queen.
That's an
Steve
iconic
Martin,
duo.
Martin Short. Mm. There's such an amazing, amazing cast as part of it. And I didn't realise this properly until I've watched it again just now. And just going, oh my gosh, that's that voice.
And in terms of the kind of behind the camera team as well, like, isn't it produced by Katzenberg and the music is done by Hans Zimmer? Like, so it's actually big names in movies.
Yeah, and it's a DreamWorks production, and so you've got Steven Spielberg as part of the kind of founding team of that, and the directors on it, one of them did Beauty and the Beast, and it's just amazing.
One of the things, it's such a top stellar team behind the whole thing, and actually you can tell how much care and dedication has gone into producing this film, because it's an adaptation of such a beloved and spiritually significant film to three of the major faiths in the world.
Yeah, so I watched the kind of behind the scenes as part of this because I'm a nerd and I love it. And
love the behind the scenes stuff.
Oh, like the Lord of the Rings stuff, I could sit there for hours and watch it. But for Prince of Egypt, they did speak to lots of different faith leaders and ask what would be appropriate and inappropriate of the Jewish, the Christian, and the Muslim faith. So they've gone for all three. And I think I sent you a screenshot at the end of the film, after all the credits. There's a quote from the Torah, from the Bible, from the Quran, about Moses from each of it. So they've taken it from all three kind of stories and weaved it together to make sure it's appropriate for all these Abrahamic faiths. And there is lots of care taken with it. But I do have a but. I think if there was...
It's well moisturised.
Yes, exactly. Nearly, soon. if this was done today, there would definitely be questions about the casting and the lack of ethnic diversity there. So there is Danny Glover, who is a black actor who plays Jethro in it. And there's an amazing lady called Ofra Haza, I think Haza is her name, who is the voice of Yuhebed, so Moses' mother. They give her a name in this. And she is Jewish. She came from Israel. Her singing voice in this is just beautiful. But the fact that it's a mainly kind of white, a lot of British people cast... I think if they did it today, there would be, you know, why isn't anyone Egyptian? Why isn't there are some Jewish members of the cast, but that you know, it's not as authentic as I think if it was done again today, it should be. Am I right?
Yeah, no.
Am I wrong?
Yeah, I think you are. Yeah, when you look at so much of what was going on during the 90s, there's a lot of really great stuff coming out, but there isn't so much the attention to either diversity or representation that might be a really helpful thing to have in such a story. But going for names that do bring in star power and people who are at the top of their game as well.
Yeah.
And that's the tension in casting, I think. On one hand, making sure that you're getting people who are going to tune in and watch because big names draw big audiences. But equally, actually, this is a story that is a cultural story to three major cultures. And actually, well, three major religions and faiths, but actually, culturally speaking, are those voices represented in the cast too?
Yeah, and a sort of a contemporary film would be Pocahontas, which was released in 1995. And again, beautiful movie, but huge questions about the involvement of Native and First Nations tribes and predominantly white cast, and also the betrayal of that story as well, which is an historical story which has been romanticised when it really shouldn't have been. So I wonder if some of those same questions could be mapped onto A Prince of Egypt. But then at the same time, we have seen that, at least from behind the scenes, they did spend time in conversation with religious leaders.
And in slight defence of Pocahontas, Powhatan and Pocahontas are both Native American actors who play it. The singing voice is different, but there are some people in there. Yes, she doesn't look right, which is, I think, is something that they do actually do quite well with Prince of Egypt, is that, you know, it would be so easy for them to just go, oh, we'll make Moses white, and Moses is not white. Like, they've thought about skin tone and skin colour as part of that. But yeah, there's a little bit, like, I think if it was done today, Gal Gadot, she would play Miriam, wouldn't she? Like, that's who they would do, and like you'd probably get like Remy Malek as part of it, and all of this kind of thing, just to be a bit more authentic and representative.
I think what else that the film does really well in paying tribute to and honouring the cultural traditions that inform the story is the way that they do the music as well.
Definitely.
A lot of the music is amazing. You know, sounds very Jewish.
And the bits where they drop into Hebrew. As well. It is just beautiful. And the Hebrew bits are the emotional swells as well.
Yeah.
Where it would have been really tempting to put those in English or whatever language that's been dubbed in, because, you know, say, well, this is the point we want people to pay attention to, but for that to be in Hebrew was our beautiful moment. Let's talk about our favorite songs.
Oh my goodness.
So I think mine is Deliver Us, and I really how that's used as a theme then at other places in the soundtrack as well.
Oh, fun fact, Deliver Us was the first song they wrote for it, and so it really set the tone for the whole thing.
Sure.
And so when they came out, it's Stephen Schwartz was the lyricist for it, and Hans Zimmer does the music. It's just fantastic. So that was the first song they wrote, and it helped to set the tone for the whole film of, this is where these people are, we feel emotionally attached to them. And I thought, oh, that makes sense that was the first film.
It's nice that actually it starts with the Hebrew people as slaves, and then actually it ends with the Hebrew people being free. That is the opening and closer. Yeah. Yes, it's the story of Moses and Ramesses and whoever, whatever. But actually, as you say, that song, Kate, sets the tone, opening and then takes us through to the end.
Yeah.
My favourite, I think, is one in the middle. It's Through Heaven's Eyes. It's a song that is sung by Jethro. I mean, I love them all, and I will sing to them all super loud on my own, thinking that I can carry the tune. But
I'm sure you can.
I think that's very kind. But yeah, Look at Your Life Through Heaven's Eyes kind of is the song that really accompanies Moses's spiritual transformation.
Yeah.
As he leaves his royal life behind and really embeds himself into this shepherding, nomadic lifestyle and realizing his worth, realizing what matters in life, the values that underpin the community he's ended up marrying into, as he marries Zipporah as well. I'm going to say through heaven's eyes.
Yeah, and I think maybe what this song captures, at least in that transformation of Moses, is it really ties into where the Hebrew people are in their history and what Moses represents. Because the way that the Hebrews got to Egypt, well, they were led by Joseph, and Joseph was very much treated like a prince and went from being a farming nomadic people to taking up to being more more situated, more settled in Egypt with high status leaders. And then now, generations later, here we have the Hebrew people are now slaves in Egypt, but we have the leader who begins as a prince and becomes a shepherd. And I really like that narrative mirroring there.
That's gorgeous.
There's a symmetry there, which is actually really powerful.
Yeah.
Just quickly jumping back to one of my favourite lines from your favourite song, Kate, Deliver Us, is send a shepherd to shepherd us. Love
beautiful.
It.
Beautiful.
And for Christian viewers, we may look ahead and may hear that and think Jesus is the good shepherd. Yeah. Ruthie, what's your favourite song?
So, I mean, we can't have this discussion without talking about When You Believe, which is just such a classic one, so much so that it's sung in the end credits by Whitney Houston and Mariah Carey. I mean, iconic. And it is a fantastic one, and it just sums up the whole film about faith and perseverance and all of that. But my favourite bit of music from the film isn't one of the songs. It's part of the score.
Oh, okay.
And it's
well, let's say that your favourite song is...
Yeah, I'll go for that.
But music is different. Yeah, there we go. But tell us about the music.
Yeah, so it's done by Hans Zimmer, who is just fantastic and is just, amazing. And packs an emotional punch. And the score for the bit, for the burning bush scene, is one of my favourite pieces of music. And I've used it in sermons and reflections as to kind of score the background of me reflecting and helping people to leave it. Because it's this music that's about this encounter with God, and it's just so powerful and so moving, and I love it. I love it. So that's my favourite bit of music in it, is the burning bush scene music.
I feel like I've used it in a service, possibly stealing from you. I think you told me that at college or something.
Yeah, I did it in curacy, so it was early on, so I loved it. Yeah, and it's a great piece of music. Just the whole soundtrack's fantastic, isn't it? So... Yeah,
I think When You Believe, it's a song as well that's got a really strong cultural impact, because I remember when the X Factor 2008, Leona Lewis won and she released it, and it was Christmas number one, and like it, you know, and actually it's a song that encapsulates the message of Hebrew faith and the Christian faith, but also seems to have percolated into the vibes of even the non-religious peoples.
And it is Michelle Pfeiffer who sings on that track. It's not someone else.
Yeah, and Sandra Bullock, I think, as well, isn't it?
I think it is Sandra Bullock. Is it not Sandra Bullock? With someone else. But, Miriam's Brenda Chapman, apparently. There we go.
But, oh, I saw Brenda.
Or Sally Dworsky. She's one of those.
Oh, nice one, Sally.
But it is Michelle Pfeiffer.
But Michelle Pfeiffer, of course, has a background in musicals because she was Grease 2 was her breakout role.
She
was Sandy in Grease 2.
I've forgotten that.
Yeah. And then, of course, we know her later on from Hairspray.
Oh, yeah. What a queen. Amazing. Yeah.
Anyway, we probably shouldn't talk too much about Michelle Pfeiffer right now, because we could do, I'm sure, we could camp out on her. But let's move on.
I've revealed some of my fun facts that I know about this through there, but I wanted to tell you about one in particular, which I think is really amazing. You may well have heard this before, but the voice of God in it, I think, is really, really fascinating. Have you heard this? You know
this
about
it. Yeah, I love this fact. Yeah, yeah.
Did is they got the entire cast to record the lines of God in the film. And so the whole cast says the lines of God, and they hoped it would just be a cacophony of all these different voices. But then when they played it back, they realised that they needed to have one kind of main voice to do it. And so it's Val Kilmer who plays Moses. So it's like that inner dialogue with God, and hearing the voice of God is you reflecting. And I just think that's such a useful and clever device to use as part of it. So I wanted to make sure I slipped that fun fact in there.
That's a good fact.
No, I think that's a really cool casting decision, like creative decision to go for, because there's something about how God is cast in other movies, and that's probably worth an episode in itself for us to
do. Ooh, yeah.
You know, like, you know, suddenly that person becomes the voice of God. That person is, you know, Morgan Freeman is
Morgan
God.
Freeman.
You know, that's the obvious go-to in many ways. And, but actually, and that can create the sense of God being someone who is distant or someone who is other to us. And there are benefits to that kind of creative decision, absolutely.
Yeah.
But there is something, I think, about the intimacy and the closeness of God to us in that decision to cast Val Kilmer as God relating to Moses.
Well, and because a lot of the time when you hear God's voice, it's not going to be someone else's voice. And I think that's why people think, oh, God didn't speak to me because that was just my inner monologue. But actually,
Morgan Freeman didn't leave me a voicemail.
Yeah, Morgan Freeman didn't whisper in my ear.
Shame. I think it also says something about being made in the image of God, that actually, amongst that, there is this voice that comes from us. And it's just amazing. Mm. And there's lots of clever decisions that are made in the film. But they do take some artistic license with it. Like, of course they have to, because it's a film. And the focus for the story of the Prince of Egypt kind of differentiates from the Bible, because the focus for the film becomes about Moses and his relationship with his brother, his adoptive brother, of Ramesses. And they change the story with bits of this to focus on that bit. And so there's these two brothers who are brought up equally but go in very different directions. And to show, that tension between, you know, two have gone very different ways and yet they're still brothers.
Yeah, to compare it to a more contemporary movie, it's the sort of Thor-Loki dynamic from the Avengers movies. Like, obviously Moses doesn't go completely evil, but to Ramesses, Moses does, because Moses is bringing destruction to Egypt, they really focus on this relationship, which isn't explored at all in the Bible, and in doing so they erase the role of Aaron, depending how you would pronounce it, actually, by trying to create these intimate moments where Moses and Ramesses are speaking, you lose the fact that Moses was so nervous to speak to Pharaoh and didn't want to speak in front of crowds that God anointed Aaron to be the one who spoke in public, Aaron being Moses' biological brother. And it says things, you know, like when Moses and Aaron appeared before Pharaoh and they said to him, that's what's in the biblical version.
I can understand why they would make the decision to focus more on sort of the Egyptian brother than the Hebrew brother, because I think from a narrative perspective you've got to fill more gaps as to how does Moses know Aaron, what is their relationship like, how is it one built upon trust and a shared desire, when in the premise of the film they don't grow up together and it's only revealed to Moses that Aaron is his brother, and to Moses that he is in fact a Hebrew when he is an adult.
And that's not in the Bible. Like, Moses would have known he was a Hebrew.
No, indeed. But also the focus in having it between Moses and Ramesses becomes a focus for the relationship between the Hebrew people and the Egyptian people in itself. And that is the conflict between those who are enslaved and those who oppress them. So I can see exactly why they made that decision. And also because of that trope of brothers at war, it turns it into a family drama as well. But one that allows them to be somewhat faithful to the text in adaptation.
Yeah, and the film is called The Prince of Egypt. So we're told right from the beginning this is about Moses and his relationship to Egypt. And the story finishes on the other side of the Red Sea, whereas the Book of Exodus goes on and actually it's the whole journey through the wilderness and Moses going up to get the Ten Commandments and the Hebrew people really wrestling with rebuilding their culture post-slavery and rebuilding religion and trying to find their identity and trying to find the promised land. And, you know, if they decided that actually they want to tell that whole story, I imagine that the brother relationship would have been young Moses forms a secret friendship with young Aaron without knowing that they're brothers. And then it's revealed later on. Like, that would have been the story. But they decided to give us this chunk of Moses' starting point and leading the Hebrews to freedom. Whereas actually, if you tell the full story, it's not quite a triumphant end to the narrative. They finish the story on a high point with Prince of Egypt, rather than the continual ups and downs that follow on.
Except that I always think this when it finishes with Moses bringing down the Ten Commandments and Moses looks over his people, and I always think, oh, Moses, you don't know what you're going to encounter down there. Like, it's not gone well.
Gone well. You're going to find some golden calves.
Can anyone see the golden calf animated in that? The animation in this is amazing, isn't it?
It's beautiful.
I didn't realise how much of it is computer animated as well. Like, it flows really well together. But actually quite a large chunk of it is computer animated. And you see the... on the making of and all their old, like, big box computers and, loads of it is computer animated as well. So, like, the chariot sequence where they're racing, so the horses and the people are hand-drawn, but the chariots are created from a computer.
That's interesting.
They're really getting to grips with that technology in the 90s. Like Beauty and the Beast had done some really pioneering stuff with that. You go back to Oliver and Company as well. So, you know, they're really at the top of their game in terms of that blend of hand-drawn animation with CGI aids.
And sorry to go back to the focus on the story of Ramesses and Moses. I've just remembered something else that they do. They gloss over the plagues of Egypt a bit. They kind of steamroll through, and they also they add this bit to try and make it more justified by really amping up the emotion with Pharaoh and Moses. And by adding him threatening to repeat the slaughter of the firstborn himself, and then that's why that final plague with the slaughter of the Egyptian firstborns happens, which I found really interesting in that sense of, oh, you're trying to justify something which is quite horrific, actually, there.
I think we will come back to that kind of discussion later on. But I just wanted to talk about the kind of, well, I think it's the key sequence, but you disagree with me, Kate, don't you? Of the burning bush scene with the music that I love so much.
Ooh, okay. So I want you to make your pitch, Ruthie, and then Kate, you can make your pitch, and then I will decide who I agree with more.
So, again, going back to watching the behind the scenes, the animators and the directors decided that this was the key pivotal scene, and the way that yeah, it just starts as an ordinary day, and Moses has kind of got himself, he's moved away from Egypt, he's got himself a wife, he's comfortable where he is, and then he's just doing his average day job, and then a sheep appears and runs off, and then he follows the sheep. And then there's this just really ethereal bush, and the soundtrack's amazing, and then you've got the voice of God, which is all these voices on top of each other, and yes, it's a shorter sequence, and it doesn't, you know, include all the miracles that God does trying to persuade Moses, I've given you this job, you've got to go do it. But it has that really beautiful moment of I am who I am, and just Moses takes off his sandals. For the rest of the film, he doesn't wear any shoes from that moment of standing on holy ground. And just, I think it mainly for me, it's the music and the swell of it. And then you know, I will be with you, Moses. And just him going, his face goes from like bewilderment, frightened, scared, amazed, and just... And the way he runs back afterwards to go see his wife and grabs her and is like you don't hear the dialogue, but you imagine him going, oh, I just encountered God and he showed me the staff and I'm not wearing my shoes anymore because I was on holy ground and God's got a plan for me and all this stuff. I just, I love it. But Kate, tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, it's not that you're wrong. I think it's just personal taste. So I feel like it's too abridged. I feel like it's not... So for me, it's one of those really, really big moments. And in a way, I think, although the music and the etherealness and the pretty lights and all of that are lovely, for me, it needs to be a lot more... Like, I would want there to be no music.
Ooh.
And I would want there to be that stillness and a kind of really clearness to the voice. Maybe because I've seen it in other animated versions of this, but I think for me it's something about it not being so magical and other that it's weird. Suddenly this bush is on fire and Moses goes to investigate and then hears the voice of God, and the reason you know there's something different happening is because the soundtrack has cut off, like, and so maybe like leading up while he's following the sheep he got that inquisitive soundtrack, but then as soon as he encounters the burning bush the music would stop. Like, for me, that would be more powerful, but that's just, I think, personal taste. And like I said, I would want it to be longer. It felt for me like it was too merged with the Through Heaven's Eyes song, and for it being more like Moses being brought into that community, which I think it's right, but I don't know, I just felt, I don't know, it just it wasn't what I have in my head. Well, basically, it wasn't what I have in my head when I read that story.
Thank you both. What do I think? I think it's really interesting, the artistic licenses that they take with it. I like the fact that he is a shepherd who is following a lost sheep. It feels like a little allusion to the parable that Jesus tells. I hear your idea about silence, Kate, and I can see it working really well in a different movie.
Yeah,
I think with this movie, which is primarily aimed at children who are used to watching Disney films, that to have silence would be a really difficult thing, especially if you're trying to make that scene then longer. I think kids are going to get bored. I think kids are going to disengage. And I think the visuals that they bring are, I think they are beautiful, and they do try to capture that sense of something wonderful is happening that is beyond belief. And I think with any other composer than Hans Zimmer,
you can't cut off Hans
they
Zimmer.
May struggle to they may struggle with the, you know, to capture that sense of epic and awe. And I think it comes at a really important time. I mean, I'm going to slightly disagree with you in terms of it merging too much with Heaven's Eyes, because I don't know what scene you would put in between Heaven's Eyes and this that would drive the story forward and that would make a difference. I think visually you see the comfort that Moses has with this new life. But actually the spiritual lesson of, hey, don't be comfortable when there's injustice out there and you can do something about it. And that's the wake-up call that Moses needs. Yes, it's going through at a really fast pace, but again, it's a film for children.
No, it's not. And, it's for grown-ups. It's about... That's why we're talking about it as grown-ups.
I beg your pardon. It is a film whose primary audience is intended to be children.
Yeah.
But is much adored by adults alike.
Yeah.
Is that fair? Is that fair?
Let's talk a bit about adaptation then. And because they do change the story as part of this. I don't think they do it really, really dramatically, but there are certain bits that they change because it will help with the story plot for a film. And we noticed that in other places as well, where, like, if you look at children's Bibles, they change the stories to make it more palatable for children. And I always find it interesting looking at children's Bibles and how they deal with the Noah story, because it's always in there, because it's, yay, animals, and, oh, lots of people drown at the beginning. Like, how do they do that? And can we think of, like, story the changes that they make in the film?
Are we focusing on the Prince of Egypt right now?
Yeah, we'll just focus on the Prince of Egypt. And, I mean, my knowledge is limited, but actually that might be some of the bits that are added because that's part of the Quran. But what, as we know Exodus best, where might the changes be?
I think it's really interesting that they introduce Zipporah earlier on. So they had a scene where Zipporah is presented as a sort of slave girl for the enjoyment of one of the princes of Egypt. And I, you know, and like from a story perspective, that's important because it sets her up as a character who we're going to meet later on, and that that makes for a stronger story. And it also brings about that sense of justice and sets, you know, you know, we see how Moses feels awkward about the way she's being treated, but not yet enough to necessarily.
His mum shakes, you know,
stand up for her
him
dignity
when he makes her fall in the pool of water, and so it's only fair that she drops in the well.
Yeah, they also add a lot more in of Moses' privilege as a prince, whereas in the Exodus narrative, we jump from him being found by Pharaoh's daughter to one day after Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and saw their forced labour, and he beats the Egyptian to save the Hebrew who's being struck down. And it kind of... So although that in itself is a privileged act... because as a prince of Egypt, he can enact that violence, but that's not actually what the slaves need. But we don't have as much of that. How is he actually, you know, how do, in the film we have, he doesn't realise he's privileged, and he has to come to that realisation in terms in many additional ways.
Yeah. They do change the, it's the, instead of the daughter, it's Pharaoh's wife who finds Moses. Probably that makes it slightly less weird. I don't know.
I mean, knowing what we know about the Egyptian royal dynasties, daughter could also be a wife. Let's say that.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Knowing what we know about those dynasties.
And we've mentioned already about Aaron's role in it and that his role is diminished in order that it's Moses who does more. And we do kind of skip along with the plagues, don't we? And I realised this because I ended up watching part of this with my four-year-old and going, ooh, he's asking questions and we don't quite know how to answer them, like when the angel of death comes round and it's like, oh, this is a bit scary, Mummy. What's it doing? And going, oh, well, it's killing all the firstborns of Egypt, but I probably not shouldn't say that to my four-year-old. And, you know, why is Moses sad? And it was because he's fallen out with his brother Ramesses, and Ben was like, well, Moses should say sorry and apologize. Like, yeah, no, kind of, but no. And The plagues and are horrific.
They diminish the sense of this is, it's not just Egyptians being punished so that they will set the Hebrews free. In the biblical narrative, there's also a sense of proving that the Hebrew God is the real God and more powerful than the Egyptian magicians. And because the Egyptian magicians saying, well, we can do this. Yeah. We can turn water into blood, etc.
In the Bible as well, I nearly said in the Bible version, in the Bible, we have the exchange between Moses and Pharaoh is a lot more extended.
Yeah.
And actually, the first request isn't let my people go. It's let us go and worship God in the wilderness for 3 days.
Yeah.
And so it's a much more slow, inch by inch process until they finally get to let my people go.
Yeah.
And I like the way that they do, though, the plagues, because it does sort of do them quite quickly, but that actually we don't know the level of the conversations going on during that time. And the music again that they have, I think, captures that hauntingness. Mm-hmm. I think it's good for us to be scared and unnerved by this sequence. It's not a bad thing to be scared of Bible stories that are scary and that are horrific.
But then they definitely reduce the bits that make you particularly question God. So in theological college, I wrote an essay about, is God wrathful? And one of the big texts that you look at if you're thinking about is God a God of wrath, as you look at Exodus.
Mm.
And things like, which I don't include in the movie, it's not Pharaoh who hardens his own heart, it's God who hardens Pharaoh's heart. And so you've got this question of, well, if these plagues are to punish the Egyptians for having hard hearts, but God gave them hard hearts to begin with, what's happening here? That's not at all touched on as a question. And actually, that's a question we're supposed to be wrestling with, is who is God that has this power and uses this power?
Yeah.
It's interesting. And then they also take away the stuff about the increased restrictions on the Hebrews, such as forcing them to make bricks for their houses without straw, etc. Which kind of...
But it's suggested in that double their workload, I think, one of the things Pharaoh does say in the movie. So it's sort of suggested and glossed over. And the way that Aaron complains about, you know, how much worse Moses has made things by pleading for justice and freedom. So I think the spirit of those verses is captured. And I think, to me, that is the more important thing in an adaptation, to try to remain faithful to, I want to say the vibe, but to the spirit of the story.
Good vibes only.
It's that interesting thing where I'm just skimming through. I've got the Bible next to me and I'm skimming through. And in a biblical narrative, we don't start with the idea that all the Hebrews are going to be released. There's more of a sense of you need to make their lives better and stop oppressing them. And it's only after Pharaoh pushes back and makes things harder for the Hebrews that it becomes, let my people go. So anyway, we've pointed out there are quite a few differences. But is that bad? Probably not, because this is trying to present the story in a way that will be engaging. That, you know, there is a limited time frame. It's picking a specific narrative point from which to tell the story. And often, even in adult, in translations for grown-ups, which aren't, you know, children's versions of Bibles, all of translation is interpretation, and every translation has a specific agenda in what it's trying to communicate.
And in adaptation especially, the decision always has to be made, actually, whose story are we telling? Mm. Now, you could go to, if we take Pride and Prejudice as a random example, is this a story where we're focusing primarily on Lizzie and Darcy? Or are we going to be focusing on this as a story which is...
about Mr. Collins.
Or Mitchell Cates, and you want your Mr. Collins justice, you so you could make it a story. But it's looking at, how do we look at the story? Is it through the lens of, actually, Lizzie is someone who is after one great love. If, of course, for Pride and Prejudice, the big question is, what is it that she falls in love with? Is it Darcy? Is it Pemberley?
Is it the fact that he looks after her family?
Yeah, so, you know, and actually those are all different ways of telling the same story. And we can see that in comparing different adaptations.
Mm. And it's where there's different adaptations have come from. So, like, there's a book called Longbourn that I've not read that's from the servant's perspective. Have you? Is it good?
It's really good. It's really good, yeah. It's really good. Highly recommend it. It has... No, I won't.
Don't give me spoilers.
But it's very
good.
But
I've read other ones.
It's very, very good.
I read one called Mr. Darcy's Diary, I think, that's the story of Pride and Prejudice, but from Darcy's perspective. And I'm sure there's other stuff from different perspectives.
Yeah, there's ones from...
Is there a Mary one recently,
there's a few from Mary. Yeah, there's one from Mary's. There's one called What Kitty Did Next, which is about kind of what Kitty does next. So it's what is the viewpoint that this movie is trying to give us? And this isn't the story for First Passover. And I think most of us, when we're hearing this story, we'd hear it around this time of year and we're learning about that First Passover during the final plague, which is the slaughter of the firstborns, and the Hebrews sacrifice lambs and put the blood on their doorways, and they bake unleavened bread and prepare to escape. Yeah. And for Christians, we link that to a foreshadowing of Jesus as the Lamb of God and that sacrifice. And obviously for Jewish people, there's a huge significance around the Passover festival, which is this time of year.
There's a great tradition in Jewish, I don't know whether you call it academia, thought. It goes way back to the earliest rabbis in the rabbinic tradition of Midrash, which is using storytelling as a way to try and answer the mysteries that the scriptures don't give. My favourite example is one I learned through someone who was speaking at the Network of Biblical Storytellers. They're a group, they're international, but they have once a year festival gathering in America. And I went along, and this woman called Noah Baum, or Baum, Noah as in N-O-A, Baum, B-A-U-M.
Yeah, Baum.
And she spoke about this story, which is in the middle of Numbers, which is about five sisters who come to Moses and say, it is unfair that our father's inheritance should go to his brother's son and not to us, his daughters. Moses goes away and thinks about it and prays, comes back and says, yes, it is unjust. You should get your father's inheritance and it shall be so. And she told it as this sort of great, it's a great little feminist text of women standing up for what should be right and it coming through to them. But the Midrash seeks to explore and answer the question, why does Moses change the law for these women? And the Midrash suggests that they are giant Amazonian women perhaps slightly intimidating to Moses. And that's why things change. So Midrash, I guess, seeks to answer those questions. Midrash upon Midrash upon Midrash, and you're supposed to read them alongside the scriptures as well. Look at Midrash.
It's a dwelling in the narrative, which is conversational and seeks to help us inhabit the narrative and for us to see these narratives not just as stories, but as living people. So, you know, Moses isn't just a character. Moses was a person, and we're trying to build out that person and personality. Yeah. I think I'm not an expert in Midrash, so if anyone who's listening says, "Oh no, that's completely wrong," please do correct us.
Inform us on Midrash. I would like us to head towards then as doing our own films, because there are plenty of these kind of animated stories around. So DreamWorks, who did this one later, did Joseph, King of Dreams, and there's stuff like The Miracle Maker. There's VeggieTales, there's Story Keepers. There was one that you said about called Testament, Bible and Animation.
Yeah, one which we had a lot, which called Testament, the Bible and in Animation, and had the song Adiemus as its intro song, and did loads of different animation style versions of stories from the Old Testament and the New Testament. And yeah, we had a VHS box set. And I particularly enjoyed the story of Ruth watching that one. Because that was done in claymation.
Oh, there we awesome. Go. I remember growing up quite a lot on VeggieTales. And
Of course.
Ended up on a VeggieTales hole on YouTube the other day. I was surprised by how many of the lyrics of Silly Songs of Larry I still know off by heart.
Oh, yeah.
I can sing you the song of the Cebu if I need to. And all of this. And there's so many more of them. And I think we haven't really asked the question about whether it's a right thing for us to do these kind of animations, because I think we're all on the same kind of boat that actually adapting these passages sensitively and thinking about it actually helps convey the story and helps interest people to find out more and explore it more.
It helps those the headlines of the story and the key points settle into your brain a lot easier. So particularly like with the VeggieTales ones, even with the songs, like one of the ones I watched a lot was Esther.
Me too.
and the battle is not ours. We look to God above, for He has. But it helps you learn parts of the scripture, and yes, the story is a lot more complex, but it helps you have that starting point. It's like Sunday school simplifies these stories for us. We learn the Sunday school versions of these stories, and then as we age we start to learn all the more complicated bits, all the bits that make us say ooh, that makes me uncomfortable, but are really difficult to explore with children, because actually the point of these stories is that they're meant to make us question, and at different ages we have different questions.
I want to challenge that a little bit, not because I disagree. But again, it's to do with adaptation and the simplification of these stories, and actually what does that turn the stories into, and what do we lose about these stories instead.
The issue is when the simplification overtakes and becomes the known version.
Yeah, like the media that we consume, you know, especially at a young age, forms the way that we're going to think about things potentially forever. And actually it may well be that people grow up and don't revisit the story of Esther, but they think, oh, it's a story about when actually God is barely mentioned in the actual scriptural text.
God isn't mentioned.
Not at all.
Yeah, that's one of the facts about Esther.
So actually, again, we're back to actually what is the story that we're telling? Is this story about a woman who is close to God's heart? Is this a story about a woman who is coerced into fighting for her people? Is it about a beauty pageant princess winner? You know, like actually, you know,
we're
and actually,
peas.
You know, and so even in the simplification of a story for children, we can sometimes inadvertently or openly and kind of gratuitously or dangerously give them false good news.
Yeah, so it's, I know it's Lent, but Ross, I know we're going here, so tell us about nativity plays.
So, nativities, I'm fascinated by the Nativity because it is the story that is that everyone thinks they know. And actually, the Nativity is adaptation. It is a made-up narrative that takes the birth narrative of Matthew's Gospel and the birth narrative of Luke's Gospel and mashes them together. This was something that was done by, if I remember correctly, Saint Francis. And it was kind of a fresh expression. I visited the place, I think it's called Greccio, in Italy, where the first Nativity was done. And it was kind of part of his fresh expression movement to re-engage people with the gospel and with church. And so that's where you get three kings and a donkey and that kind of idea. There is no innkeeper. There is no donkey. There are no three kings in the story. There are Mary and Joseph come to Bethlehem. That's all we're told. We just know that there were three gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh that the unnumbered magi bring with them.
Later and not to Bethlehem.
Yeah, you know, there is no room at the inn is not a phrase that turns up, that is not in the Bible. Certainly not spoken by an innkeeper. So now, sometimes I have felt really conflicted about this because we're giving people a story that isn't biblical. But then reflecting on what is, and again, back to what is the story that we're telling, some people get the story, oh, it's amazing that that the King of Kings, Jesus, was born in poverty, in a drafty stable with an open door, when actually the more that we learn about the history of the actual sort of society at the time, that's probably not the actual circumstances in which Jesus' birth took place. So are we wrong to be giving people that story from the Nativity that we tell and have kids dressing up with tea towels on their heads? Or is it okay? Because the spirit of the story is one about love and kindness and yeah,
the King of Kings being born,
and being among ordinary people, among the shepherds, kind of thing. So yeah,
we had this exact discussion when it was Nativity time this past Christmas, because I used a script from Bible Society, and this one in this script for the Bible Society, it always referred to the Magi or the wise men or the three kings as stargazers. And me and the person who did the script together were like, people aren't going to know what that is. Like, and it was in the script so many times to like emphasize the point of these aren't kings and these aren't wise men. These are stargazers. These are astronomers. Mm. And so we discussed changing the script and how we would word it. And so every time we kind of talked about that, I would use stargazers in the script as it was. But when I was getting like, I'm going to say kids, it was mostly all women who were the wise men. So it was just a load of wise women, which was fantastic. And whenever I was getting them up to do something as part of it, I would say, we're now inviting the kings, the magi, the stargazers, the wise men, the wise women, as it was, and use all those different phrases so that people knew, this is the character that I'm talking about, okay? There's a reason why it's not talked about this in the same way, but this is the focus in order that people got it.
Yeah, it's something which I think is becoming more and more common as a conversation topic nowadays, in recent years, because so my mum does is part of an Open the Book team. Open the Book is a group. It's kind of a national network of groups that use a particular method to tell Bible stories and act them out in schools. And they've recently released a new storybook, a new book of scripts, which everyone who does Open the Book has to use. And my mum was telling me about her group were debating about the Nativity story because they called Joseph a builder rather than a carpenter. which actually, according to current biblical scholarship, that's actually really up to date in that, you know, when we think of the carpenter nowadays, we think about someone who carves nice little ornaments, maybe, or maybe builds the odd piece of furniture.
Makes a chair.
It's artisan, whereas actually a carpenter would be heavily involved in construction and building houses. So you can sort of see why they've made that decision, but my mum's Open Up Book group was saying, but that's not what people will recognise. And yeah, it just caused a bit of a hullabaloo, really. So it's interesting how do we... The problem with the nativity particularly being so ingrained in our culture is that when we do want to offer maybe a little bit of a nuanced interpretation, there's often quite a bit of pushback.
Off the back of that... I just want to touch base on The Miracle Maker, which is another mid-90s biblical adaptation of the life of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so I met with... I know the writer a bit because of his association with Riding Lights. He was one of the founders of Riding Lights.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just drop that in there, Ross. I just know him.
I've been to his
castle
in Scotland on Easter. Anyway. Well, they show Jesus working as a builder at the beginning of the movie, and it's not a carpenter. Carpenters would be there on the building site because those were the tools of building a house. And actually rooting that adaptation in up-to-date biblical scholarship was really important to them. The other thing that I remember Murray saying was that they had a whole discussion about whether they were going to make figurines of Jesus to sell alongside the movie, and they decided no, because they didn't want children having Jesus figures and using those figures to, you know, in like as a soldier or putting a gun in Jesus' hand or anything like that. They didn't want Jesus to end up being misrepresented during playtime. And I thought that was a really fascinating thing. And kind of perhaps, I don't know, there's something really reverent about the image of Christ in that decision.
Mm. Yeah.
Now, I'm going to contrast you with VeggieTales. I'm going to say VeggieTales, by contrast, is very irreverent, but it gets away with it because we have the cast of the fruit and vegetables who are playing all the characters. So you know that they are acting out these stories. And also, it's a living piece of broccoli or asparagus or a blueberry.
Junior asparagus.
Which you're not going to be like, that's what Jesus looked like. Because it is so wild and wacky, I think it gets away with a lot more in terms of having more fun with the stories. And I think their purpose is to show that you can have fun in faith. And it doesn't have to always be. I mean, reverence is important, but I think VeggieTales' purpose is meant to be a bit silly. So the different mediums, I think it's really important that something like The Miracle Maker, they were trying to be more representative because it's meant to be a bit more of a serious film.
Yeah.
But like each of these, they have their different purposes. So like Story Keepers, which is one that we mentioned in passing, that's about children from the modern day going into the stories, isn't it? If I remember it correctly.
No, is it? It's the early church, isn't it?
Oh yeah, no, that's about the early it's about the early church. But they're telling the stories and they are distance in a way from the stories because they're telling them rather than
separate. They're all chasing away from the Romans.
Yeah, whereas the Testament Bible animations are meant to be a more serious representation. So you've got those different levels of how are we going to tell the story. It's like you wouldn't take Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat as an accurate representation of the story.
Are you telling me Pharaoh wasn't like Elvis?
They didn't have a singing narrator.
There's all these different adaptions, but I think the question that I want to finish on is, If you were to do your own adaptation, you were to direct a film, and we'll stick with animated film, because there might be differences if you choose live action and using real people. If you were to use a Bible story and adapt it for an animated film, which story would you go for, and why will it be one that's in the Old Testament?
Yeah. Okay, so I'd want to do some of the lesser known heroes.
Oh, yes.
I really want to do something about Deborah, because Deborah is so important and just doesn't get any attention from
Deborah
his
the
animated
judge.
Versions. So,
that'd be great.
The first one I wrote down was Samson. I'd love to explore Samson.
That's proper Game of Thronesy, isn't it, bits of it?
Yeah, I think there's something really fascinating about judges. I don't know if it would work animated, to be fair. That might be more live action Game of Thronesy.
Yeah.
A Game of Thronesy just of judges, like a Game of Thrones adaptation of judges as a whole.
A book of judges.
Oh, that would be really good.
I then wrote down, thinking specifically about animation, the Book of Revelation came to mind. I think that would be so awesome animated.
Yeah.
And I think it would really be able to capture the surrealist. And I think you could do some really beautiful imagery with it.
Yeah.
With some really great artists. Mm. Trying to just capture the scale and the magnificence of the vision.
Yeah.
Mm. I also think, and I think it would work best with animation, maybe some of Paul's journey around the Mediterranean.
With
the shipwrecks and the imprisonment and the jailbreaks and all that kind of thing, and the arguments between Peter and Paul and that kind of thing, I think could be done really fabulously with animation, really amping up the drama.
Counter proposal. You know, those live action Hercules and Xena warrior princess.
Oh yeah.
I think that. The journeys of Paul. I just see it in my
it's
mind.
So camp.
That campiness and ridiculous drama and bad CGI. Like, yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And Paul not wearing many clothes at all.
Yeah.
But built like a.
Just in the leather loincloth. And absolutely stacked.
I've gone off the idea now. I don't know why. That should be my thing.
Whereas I thought, I'd love to do an animated version of Ruth. And I know I'm biased because it's my name. But it's just such a wonderful story. And leads into so much of the... You know, the story of Jesus and all the links that go through. That would be amazing. Mm-hmm. I did think of Deborah too, so I'm glad that you mentioned Deborah.
Mm.
And I think creation would be fascinating to do with animation. And how would you know, suggest nudity and all of this, but subtle and, it'd be amazing.
I've always liked the idea of David as... poet. I mean, again, David kind of fits so many different types of person, but I like the idea of opening a movie with David and Psalm 104, which is a poetic retelling of creation.
Ooh.
And the idea of David sitting on top of a hill, beholding the sunrise, and you see all of the things that he writes about, kind of mirroring that journey, that progression of creation, in Genesis 1. Mm. And then I would love to do a bit of a biography of how the story of David then relates to the story of Jesus somehow. And there'd be some really interesting, I know there is stuff out there that seek to do that.
Yeah.
And I've not seen them.
I think what would be really interesting would be to do, it would be an animated series where you have, it's a story of Jesus, but it's it's kind of each episode is a story of a different person who encountered Jesus. So Ooh. We have the story of Jairus's daughter, but like the story begins with exploring who she is, and then she gets ill and she passes away, and then you know Jesus comes into her life, but then she continues on and
yeah, that's actually the lens that Miracle Maker is told through. The Miracle Maker takes Jairus' daughter, and Marie, just name dropping again, but he kind of calls it the gospel according to Jairus' daughter.
I'd like that episodic kind of version where you kind of get the glimpses of Jesus in people's lives, but you see the focus is more on how these people's lives were affected by Jesus and the changes that happened. And, you know, over the course of a series, you'd get the kind of Jesus's whole story, but glimpses from how it's directly affecting the lives of people. I'd love that idea.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think we need to draw to a close because we're going on long.
Thank you, Ruthie, for bringing us The Prince of Egypt. This took me way back to when I was a student of theatre, film and television. And I used to think a lot about how would I tell this as a story, and maybe I'll find time to revisit some of that in my new context.
You're welcome.
Hello, listeners. Let us know which Bible story you have a creative vision for. What would you do with a Bible story, adapting it for film or TV? And this is a great time of year to watch The Prince of Egypt. So watch it and let us know what your favourite song is, or your favourite piece of music. It's such an epic piece of cinema. Go and enjoy it.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of The Vicar's Watch Dibley. Thank you to Nat for editing our ramblings.
Any opinions expressed are our own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Church of England or any other organisation with which we are affiliated.
If you like our podcast, leave us a review, follow us on social media and share it with your friends. And, as always, bless you for listening.
Why can't you beat devout Christians in races during Lent?
Ooh.
I don't.
Because they fast.
Oh no.
They fast. I like that one.